Hi everyone, welcome back to the Who We Are podcast, where we explore the stories of extraordinary individuals who have shaped their journeys with resilience, determination and heart. Today's guest embodies all of these qualities and more. She's a woman who has not only redefined what it means to be a champion, but has also shown us the power of the human spirit. Yip Pin Siew is Singapore's most decorated Paralympian, a 7-time gold medalist, and a world record holder in the 50 meters, 100 meters backstroke, and 200 meters too, right? S2 events. But beyond the medals and accolades, Pin Siew's story is one of quiet strength, determination, and unwavering belief in herself, even in the face of seemingly insurmountable challenges. Today, we're going beyond the podium and the records. We'll be diving into the pivotal moments that shaped Pin Siew's journey, from her early days of discovering swimming to the obstacles she faced with muscular dystrophy and the personal sacrifices that she's had to make that fueled her passion. We'll also explore her reflections on life, her purpose, and the legacy that she hopes to leave behind. It's not often that we get to sit down with someone whose life is a real testament to resilience, and I'm excited to hear Pin Siew's thoughts on what drives her to keep pushing boundaries, not just as an athlete, but also as an advocate, a leader, and a human being. I hope this conversation inspires you, touches you deeply, and reminds you of the incredible strength we all hold within ourselves. Pin Siew, thank you so much for being here. I am so excited to be reunited with you again. It's been about 5 years since we first met. And, you know, we first met in Love Bonito Studio, where you were fronting a couple of our campaigns for us back then too. How have you been?
I've been really good, and it's such a pleasure to be back here together with you again. I just finished the Paris Paralympic Games.
Yes! Welcome home, and what a great result and honor you've had there. So congratulations. Thank you. I can't wait to dive deeper into that later. And for those of us who may not be as familiar with you, could you introduce yourself to us?
So I'm Yip Pin Siew, and I've been swimming competitively for the past 20 years. I've been to 5 different Paralympic Games, and from all of them, I've won 7 gold medals and a silver. I also hold 3 world records as of now, and it's been an amazing journey, because this whole journey hasn't really just been about only swimming. I've learned so much from swimming, but it's also really given me an opportunity to be such a big advocate for a lot of people in the community, the PWD community, disability community, the youth community, women community. And I just am really proud to be able to speak up for anybody who needs a voice.
Yeah, and thank you for having the courage to pursue your potential and also being such a shining light for all of us. So let's start from the very beginning. You know, when you were first diagnosed with muscular dystrophy, what was that like? When was that? And how did that shape you and your outlook on life, especially at such a young age?
My mother realized that I had a condition when I was 3 years old. So I was actually born a completely healthy and normal baby. No abnormalities.
So you were hitting all the milestones then too?
Everything was okay until I was around 3. Then my auntie realized that I was walking with a foot drop. So like, how do I explain the foot drop? It's that if I'm walking up a stairs, from the back of the
view,
it just looks very like floppy. So like I wasn't really controlling my ankle. It was just like, yeah, then up the stairs. And so my mom realized that, yeah, that wasn't normal. And we went to see the doctors. The doctors actually took a really long while to diagnose it. I did an operation on my right foot, I think, for club foot. Because the doctors thought it was just a club foot surgery. So I did the operation. It didn't get better. And so after a while, doctors realized that maybe it's more than that. You know, it could be muscular atrophy. It could be muscular dystrophy. And I didn't have the real concrete name to this whole thing until I was about 16 years old. Then we realized that it was Charcot-Marie tooth, which is a type of, which used to be a type of muscular dystrophy. But it's really just about, okay, back to biology class, about the synapses wearing off, and then the messages are unable to transmit through the synapses. So my muscles in the peripheral area get less messages, and the muscles eventually waste. So doctors were saying that this condition was is a condition that deteriorates over time. But as I get older, then it stabilizes a bit more.
So when you were 3, especially when you had your surgery to 16, before, you know, officially the diagnosis came out, what was your condition like? You know, especially this was a schooling age. You know, were you also taking part in the usual physical activities and sorts?
So my mom, I have 2 elder brothers. So she tried to really bring me up the same way that she did to my 2 elder brothers. So whatever they did, I did as well. If they went for piano classes, I would go for piano classes, and then swimming classes. That's how I got started. But how it showed was that it affected my legs when I was 3. I was actually able to walk all the way until I was 12. But I needed support foot braces. And it only affected my hands when I was 5.
Right.
So I remember trying to hide them when I was younger. Like, just wear jeans over my braces so that people couldn't tell. But of course, who was I kidding? You know, everybody could actually see that I was walking a bit different from everybody else. And I was really embarrassed when I was younger because I was so different and nobody else understood or had seen anybody else that was different from them when I was in primary school.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this was like, you know, especially when you're in primary school, we can't cover up in that sense because we have to wear the school uniform like everyone else. So what was that like for you as a young child, 7 years old, going to school, knowing that you're different from the rest and also learning how to navigate that discomfort, yet also wanting to fit into society?
It was difficult when I was a kid. I would say that I was a completely different person when I was at home and when I was in school. So when I was at home, I was full of life, very energetic, mildly irritating, as my brothers would say. But in school, I became really quiet and I didn't have the confidence to have friends or get to know anybody. The only people that would be my friends would be like the buddies that were kind of assigned to you in school.
Yeah, and the older, like they were primary 5 when you were
those
young.
Those kind. But even then, I think they also didn't understand the difference. So they were there only because they had to be there, but not genuinely because they wanted to be there.
Yeah.
As I got into older primary, then people got a little bit more empathetic. So maybe I did have a few friends then, but still, like maybe primary 1 to 4, I was bullied in school. I was very, even embarrassed to go to the toilet because going to the toilet meant that I needed help. And I would wait until I got home that day to go to the toilet.
Wow. Yeah. So you would just tolerate. And in Singapore, we say tahan.
Tahan.
All the way. Wow. You know, how did this early experience with, you know, dealing with you being differently abled from the rest of your peers, how did this experience shape you and your outlook on life as a person?
At a certain point in my adulthood, I've gone for therapy just because I really wanted to know more about myself.
Yeah.
And what I learned was that this, all of these things, like, have actually taught me to be a very tough person, which is not necessarily the best thing also. So I think that was also kind of what made me such a good athlete. But I was tough because I went through all this in school. When I went home, sometimes I also didn't dare to really tell my parents about what was going on because I didn't want to trouble them as well. You know, I genuinely feel that kids, we think that kids don't know a lot of things, but
they do.
They do. They know so much. Yeah. Even from an age of like 2 years old, 3 years old, they are well aware of what's going on. I think you might not remember it, but at that point, whatever they are feeling, it really does affect you as an adult.
And they absorb it internally. And that's also, you know, how trauma actually happens. And, you know, we're going into a therapy session now. But, you know, Bingsu, just now you mentioned also you not wanting to share with your family what you experienced in school so as not to trouble them. What did you experience in school back then?
So, like, people would throw staple bullets in my hair. I have very big hair.
It's beautiful, by the way. It's like you. A point of, like, everyone would envy you for that. Yeah.
But then, so they would try to like keep, but then, you know, like Asian girls, like Singaporean girls, all have very straight, nice, slick hair. So they'll try and put staple bullets or like eraser dust in my hair, or really just ostracize me because I was different. Mm. Back then, I'd already started swimming. So I was really like tan and golden brown, and my hair was really dry and had like streaks of brown in it as well. So
because of the chlorine in water.
Because of
yeah.
the chlorine. So everything made me look different, not just the disability, but also who I was.
Mm.
So because of that, then I wasn't really like invited to birthday parties or anything of that sort. Yeah. I don't remember a lot of it now, but there's still like key moments like me telling the teacher and the teacher not doing anything, even though the incident happened in front of her.
Wow.
Yeah.
So back then, how did you cope? What was your outlet?
I think really back then, I just stuffed everything in. You know, I just compartmentalized it really well and try not to let it affect me.
Mm.
Go home and then everything's okay. But then the next day in school, you kind of face everything again.
Mm.
And at that point in time, I was swimming every Sunday and like weekends whenever I could, but it wasn't like competitive swimming level yet. So it also wasn't an outlet.
Mm.
And for me, it really was just trying to understand why people did this. And I think I dealt with it by just giving other people an excuse.
But also, can I add that I think, you know, it was such a beautiful thing that at home, when you went home, it was a place of love where you were genuinely supported and cared for. And that was also maybe what gave you the strength, you know, to be able to grow through what you did. What role, Pingxiu, did swimming play in your life, especially in those early days?
Mm.
When did you realize that perhaps swimming is more than just therapy for you, that no, maybe the water is also a place where you genuinely found freedom to express and be yourself.
I guess swimming has always really made me feel like I wasn't that different. I could do handstands, headstands, like anybody else, that anything else that someone else could do, I could do it in the water as well.
Wow.
Yeah, and that gave me a huge sense of freedom, which I loved. I loved this feeling of catching up with my peers, not being left behind.
In the water.
In the water.
Amazing.
And that was even before I started competitive swimming. So competitive swimming has shaped me so much into the person I am today, which is why like I eventually opened a swim school and want to be able to pass on these values to the kids as well.
Yeah. That's really beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. When do you open the swim school?
I opened the swim school, Apex Swimming, after Tokyo.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that was around the time where I felt like I was ready to pass all of this knowledge down. Not just values around swimming, but also proper swimming techniques to children. And we are in Bishan and Ang Mo Kio and Bukit Timah.
Beautiful. You know, your first Paralympic goal in 2008 was such a defining moment for Singapore and for all of us as a nation. How did that victory, you know, change the way you saw yourself, not just as an athlete, but as a person?
The journey to that gold medal was really pivotal in my life. At that point in time, I started swimming competitively in 2004, early 2004.
How old were you when it was 2004, when you started competitive swimming?
Competitive.
At 12, okay.
Yes, I was 12. When I was in Beijing, I was 16.
Okay.
So 12, and competitive in the sense that we were training 12 times a week. So we were swimming.
How is that even possible? 12 times a week, that's like almost twice a day.
Yes, we were swimming 12 times a week, and then I was gymming every day as well.
Wow.
You can't ask me to do that now. I don't have the energy anymore. But yes.
That's like superhuman, yeah.
Yes, so like the entire journey really taught me so much, you know. Being able to go to different countries to compete, being able to talk to so many people I never think that I would talk to, really made me grow up and expose myself to all of this. And a lot of athletes, sometimes they only love competition or sometimes they only love training. But I'm really the kind that enjoys
both. You embrace all parts yes. of the journey.
But I love it. I love the pain in training and I love the excitement of the competition. Yeah.
Yeah. All the adrenaline, even, you know, in and out of the pool and things like that. Mm-hmm. So what did you discover about yourself, you know, when you won your first gold in the Paralympics in 2008?
I know. This one's okay. I think the biggest takeaway was at that year I was also doing my O levels, right? That's like
reality,
so long ago,
yeah.
And I didn't do that well for my O levels, so it came to a realization that if I could be a Paralympic champion, if I could be number one in the world, there is no way I cannot study, right? So I transferred all the determination from the pool, or the pain there into being a completely normal teenager. I went to poly, I did sports science. But for once in my life, when my friends asked me after school, do you want to go to McDonald's? I was like, yes, let's go.
Yeah. Wow. You know, in your journey and all of that you've experienced and in your journey as a world-class athlete, what has been the quietest and most personal battle that you've been through? The one that maybe, you know, all of us looking at your success won't really get to see.
Sometimes I feel like people think it's easy for me to do this because I've done this a couple of times and I feel like it is expected that I win. Mm. But I feel like sometimes only I understand points in the journey where I feel like I'm not ready or I'm slow, I'm not reaching my own expectations. And it's sometimes difficult when everybody goes and say, oh yeah, you did so well in training today. But if you actually look at the smaller things or the other parameters and you compare it across time, it actually wasn't a good session. So there's a lot of, there's some disjoint between how I feel and what people see. And because it needs to be on the same level because before you can move forward with a plan. But if there's some difference, then it is difficult because what their plan is might not necessarily be what I want to do or I agree on. And I think because of all of these different things, then some pressure can be pretty high.
Yeah.
Expectations on myself are high, especially when I feel like I know the whole complete truth, but everybody just sees like flowers and rainbows.
Yeah. And like you said, maybe from the outside, it looks easy, it's expected, especially now that you're on to your seventh gold medal as well. You talked earlier also about, you know, how the external lens of your success versus your own internal lens of your own success and how you see it. How do you bridge the gap that you mentioned earlier? And how do you process your victories, your setbacks, and your journey?
How do I view the lens, like the external and internal one? I think sometimes what I really do is I just shut it out, you know. Especially nearing to like very big games and things that matter, I tend to shut out the outside noises quite a bit because even after doing this for so many years, it still affects me. And the people closest to me, those on my team, those my family, my friends know. Somehow, I don't know why they know, but they know what to say to me. I didn't brief them like, guys, you can't talk about this or this, but they know not to say certain things. And that really helps.
Yeah. You know? So, when you mean say certain things or talk about certain things, you mean things that might be sensitive to you at that point in time.
Yes. So like things like, it's very easy to say like, oh yeah, good luck, come back with a gold medal. But this kind of things may actually also be like, oh, what do you mean come back with
triggering,
a gold medal?
Yeah.
It's not as easy as you think it is. But yes. I mean, of course, it also means well.
Yes.
Yeah, but it could also be like, talking about my competitors, which can also be quite difficult for me sometimes because we are taught to swim in our lane, you know? We're not taught to look at how fast other people do.
Yeah.
So really just, I just want to stay in my lane, do my own thing, and I don't need to know about anybody else.
That's such a beautiful analogy and lesson for life as well, right? And, you know, Pingxiu, you talked also about the experience that you've been through, that truly only you and the closest people around you know what you've been through to be able to achieve what you've achieved. And all of that has been so incredible. You have set world records. You have won gold medals. And, you know, you have really inspired Singapore and beyond. What has been the hardest sacrifice for you in this journey?
I don't like to view things as a very hard sacrifice, because when you see it as a very hard sacrifice, then maybe eventually you start to feel like, oh man, I've given up so much for this. But I think the one thing that I've done with my life is that all my decisions I've made have revolved around being a good athlete. So, say, for example, if I was younger and I didn't go to do an exchange program or I didn't study overseas, it was because I wanted to have the best environment for me, which was staying in Singapore. Or if I, whatever I've chosen to do in this 20 years have made me the best athlete that I can be.
Yeah.
And I would say I've given up certain things. I have sacrificed certain things, but nothing seems as big as what I want to do.
Yeah. That's really beautiful. I mean, just to think about the 12 times a week training and things like that. Those are just, you know, a tip of the iceberg of the things that you have to really give, you know, like it takes immense discipline. Right?
But I also truly believe in having a balance, you know, and it wasn't something I had when I was younger, but now,
yeah,
I need the balance. Yeah. I need to be able to have a social life. I need to have time with my family. I need to have friends. And it works because I'm able to still balance it out. I don't sacrifice swimming or the sport over something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, there have been so many moments of triumphs in your journey. Were there times where you doubted yourself? And how did you push through these periods of self-doubt?
So many. I would say there has been doubt over time. I think there was this period where it was really affecting me so much that I couldn't even sleep properly at night. I would wake up in the middle of the night and get anxious about it and then start crying.
This is before a competition.
This was somewhere in 2018. I had a change in coach, change in environment, and the new program wasn't exactly working for me. So when my times were dropping and things like that, I just really tried to do everything I could within my control to get better, be better. But once I couldn't do anything else already, I just felt really helpless. And then that was when I needed to not only do things within my control, but also talk to other people to fix the situation.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it was things like that that made me realize that I still genuinely care a lot about this sport. I mean, there also have been times where I've not been excited about competition anymore. This was after Beijing.
Yeah.
I suffered this thing called an Olympic hangover. And I didn't and I didn't really care about training or competitions that much anymore, because I didn't know what I wanted to do after that. I went to school, I was a good student, and then because of this change in routine, this change in rhythm, it was so difficult to come back again. And it took me 1.5 years
to recover from that hangover.
Yes. And then by then London came, and then it was too late.
Go again. What did you do in that 1.5 years to help you recover from the Olympic hangover?
That was my first one, and I won the medal. So at that point, I was really thinking to myself, if I'm already here, what else? You know, what else do I want in life?
You've achieved your goal.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I didn't realize that I still wanted to continue. It took me a long time. So I spent 1.5 years. I went to school. I became a good student. I did really well in school. I had a social life. I went out to parties, dating, things like that, holidays with my family. And then when I realized that, I'm starting to get really slow.
In the pool?
Yes. I had a sit down with my psychologist, and she told me, Okay, you have two options. First of all, if you don't want to do this anymore, just retire.
Mm.
And immediately when she said that, I knew that, no, that's not what I want.
Yeah, and that's the next, not the end yet.
Exactly. And the next one was, okay, just go back to train 4 times a week.
So 3 times, increase it by 3 times to 6 times a week.
Six times a week,
yeah.
And then I thought to myself, okay, it's not that bad. It's not 12 times. Let's do that one step at a time. And wow. That was how I started going back.
Wow. Mm. And that was when you realized that you still had that fire within you to pursue this.
But that was also just before London, which was my second games and the games that I didn't medal in.
Mm.
So it was really, it was kind of beautiful because there really was a lesson in there. Mm. It was like you deserve what you get. And I was like, yeah, okay, sure. Mm. So I couldn't be too disappointed also because I didn't put in 4 years worth of like, all the effort I needed to do, you know?
Mm.
And then after London, I knew immediately, straight away, okay, let's do this properly.
Yes, let's do this properly, yeah? And it truly takes, you know, that laser focus of committing back to the regime and the routine. You know, Pingxiu, when I listen to your journey and when I look at you, you are such a celebrated public figure, celebrated athlete, and you have spent much of your life in with people knowing of you, watching you, and rooting for you. How do you maintain your sense of self?
I think first you need to kind of know who you are. You know, what do you like doing in life? Do you have your own opinions and your own personality, or are you just really like moving with the wind? I think it's important to spend some time with yourself. Reflect on what you do every single day, have a purpose and know what you like and don't like. And then eventually just be very steadfast in this whole thing. If this one's difficult because a lot of people don't know themselves.
Yeah, that self-awareness. Is...
Yes, they don't have it. And it really is a completely long-ass journey to find who you really are.
Yeah.
And sometimes not, even at the age of 30, not a lot of people get to find it. Because if you're not really, like you said, the keyword is intentional. If you're not intentional with your life, if you don't know who you are, what you want, then how can people help you know who you are or what you want?
Mm.
Yeah, so it's really times like this. And one thing that I hold really dear to heart is one of the things one of my first coaches told me. He told me, regardless what you do in life, if you win, it's your win, your responsibility. But if you lose, it is also your loss, your responsibility. You don't blame the coaches, you don't blame the program, you don't blame anybody else at the end.
Wow.
You do what can be done along the way, and it is your absolute responsibility to the results are yours,
wow,
good or bad.
I love that. Mm. You know, I think it's such a reminder that life truly, at the end of the day, is we're not victims of what happens. Mm. And, you know, to take charge and take responsibilities for the good, the setbacks, the failures. Because, you know, I love this quote by John Maxwell where he says, sometimes we win, sometimes we learn. Mm. And even in the losses, the setbacks, there is so much that we can get out of that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Pingxiu, you have also broken so much barriers for para-athletes in Singapore.
Mm.
What would you like to see more of, you know, in the world of sports, especially for athletes who are differently abled?
I think in Singapore, I would like to see a stronger sporting culture. We did really well during the COVID days when everybody was on lockdown.
Yeah.
We had time to go running, meet our friends, play badminton.
So when you mean stronger sporting culture, you mean like Singaporeans being more active?
I think it comes from many different areas. You know, active is one of it, being participative, but also watching it, supporting our athletes. Even parents thinking that sports is important for their kids. Really, it's just like a whole culture where we put sports as more of a priority.
Hmm.
In the past, it was always academics first, you know. Of course, sports can be more important than a lot of things, but maybe as important, you know, for your health, for your mental health, physical health.
Yes.
And if Singapore has a stronger sporting culture, I think all our athletes will also be more supported.
Mm.
And not just able-bodied athletes, para-athletes, but really everyone. Now we have a lot of support from MCCY, so the ministry, and from Sports Singapore. But I think the next level also really is for corporates to understand that sports is of value. We have a lot of celebrities fronting brands, which is good, you know, to get to know our local people. But hopefully, eventually in time, people also see the value in sports, in athletes.
Interesting.
And they start to support them as well.
That's a very interesting point. And do you think you have come across a country that is actually a great advocate as a nation for sports, like what you had explained?
I think if we only look at sports, really, sports, America does a great job. They really support their athletes. A lot of them have, they don't really get as much support from the government, I think, but they do get a lot more support from corporates. And really, like, the whole country backing up an athlete, sending them for competitions, for seeing their journey and seeing them perform, eventually win or not win, they still 100% are behind the athlete because they have been on that journey.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah, and I think it's also important to see sports as a viable career option. Maybe not as an, not only as an athlete, but also surrounding them. Like, sometimes we may not respect coaches as much because we think coaching is easy. But high-performance coaching is not easy. Or even being a physiologist or a sports administrator, there are a lot of options. So in order for, if we want sports to be of a priority, then we also need more options in these areas.
That's a great reminder. And if there is one misconception that you can clear up about being a para-athlete or just as someone who is differently able from the mass, what would that misconception be?
That we don't train a lot, that we don't train, that the field is not competitive. Then I will encourage you to watch a few games, not only swimming, but watch the games so that you can see the spirit in it and then see the training behind, see the journey behind it, and actually get to appreciate it. As long as the sports are different, it's definitely not the same. So be it para sports or able-bodied sports, it's always going to be different. But it's about how you understand it enough to find joy in it.
And so, you know, your encouragement for us would be to expose ourselves more, you know, to the para-athletes and the sports that they play, and understand that even in that field, it is also very competitive and very tough. I'm also very curious to understand from you, with all the medals and achievements that you've had, how do you define success for yourself, and how has that evolved through the years?
Maybe in the past, success was when you won something, you know, when you have an achievement or something like that. But after the 2018 incident, where I had a lot of anxiety, it also taught me to not tie my performance to my self-worth.
I love that.
Back then, when I wasn't performing well, I was in such a bad place that I didn't feel good as a person as well. And it's really difficult to not do that because everybody sees you for your achievements. You're only in the papers when you win a gold medal, when something is there and people celebrate you. But it took me a long time to, maybe I have, I wouldn't even say I can do it with full certainty now, like this separation, but it's less. I know that if I don't, if my times are not what I want, it doesn't mean I'm a shitty person. It doesn't mean I'm lousy. And I, sometimes I still think I'm lousy, but I think everybody has those days.
No, so I get what you mean. So what I tell myself is, it's a bad day, it's not a bad life. You know, I just try, right? Because there are days where you just, whether personally or professionally, just don't meet your own expectations.
Just like, I want to go home. Just shower and get
to bed. And cry,
But really, exactly. It's a bad day only. And and just how to pick yourself up after that.
So how have you learned to pick yourself up again and again and again in your journey?
Why spend time being sad when you can be happy? I think that's what I do. Like, I get sad, but I also move on really fast because why waste time being sad, right? I mean, you learn, you reflect, you must learn something from it. You cannot just ignore it and make the same mistake again.
Yeah.
You must become a better person from it.
Wow.
And after you've learned the lesson, okay, be nicer to yourself. I think it's important to be kind to yourself.
Yes, I think it's so important to be compassionate and kind to ourselves. Yeah. What do you think has been the most fulfilling part of your journey? And is there perhaps, you know, a personal accomplishment that matters more than just winning medals?
Mm. One thing I like to say, I feel the most accomplished from this is really just seeing Singapore, the whole society when I was 16, you know, how many people knew about parasports or even what people with disabilities were doing at the time, how much accessible places we have at that time, and then compared to now 2024, what's happening in society.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't say I did it, but I think I did play an influence in more
raising
representation.
Awareness.
Correct, raising awareness. And you just look back and then see how things have changed. So much has changed.
Yeah.
And I think that is something that I am very proud to be a part of.
No, you should be so proud. And, you know, to be an advocate as well. Because I think I first also got to know a lot more about Paralympics because of you. You know, and we were so interested to follow your journey as well. And that also, you know, allow us to be more conscious that, hey, actually, you know, there is also a world where para-athletes really come together to compete competitively. So thank you for that.
No, thank you. And it's really beautiful because it has brought society together. And also you realize that there are so many different facets to, like, say, the disability community.
Yeah.
There are maybe only like a certain percentage that does sports and watch the Paralympics games.
Yeah.
Just like anybody, any other community. But there's so many more people who like to do fashion. They do things that they love to do. And
just
really,
any one of us.
So like we also cannot assume that somehow some people get mad that maybe not in Singapore, but in other countries, that if you are a person with disability, you should join the Paralympics. But we don't expect everybody in society to join the Olympics.
Yes.
So why do we expect for PWDs?
You know, this concept of resilience gets thrown around a lot, especially today. But what does resilience truly mean to you in your journey?
Resilience is something that it's not something you do in one day. It's something you do over a long period of time, and you do it over and over and over again. And you're not sure if that's the right thing to do. You're not sure if this doing this certain action, this certain path is going to lead you to success, but you do it anyway because you stick to the process. You try to find your goals, try to reach your goals. And to me, I think that is resilience. Just putting in a lot of effort into something and doing it well and hard over a long period of time until you manage to reach your goals.
Wow.
And I think not everybody gets to reach their goals sometimes, you know, but that doesn't mean that the journey is wasted. It just means you have to find a point in the journey where you pivot to do something else, or you do the same thing in a different way.
Yeah.
Yeah. And try to reach your goals. Sometimes it's not as straightforward, but it's always fun.
Love it. It's not a linear journey. And, you know, I think it's such a good reminder that at the end of the day, the person that we become in the process and in the journey perhaps is more important than just reaching the goal in itself. And thank you for being such a great living example reminding us of all of this. Now, I love to ask this question on, you know, if you could have a billboard down the streets of New York or Tokyo and Singapore that can say anything that you would like to say, what would your billboard say?
As cliche as it may sound, I think it's really to be kind to yourself. I think people don't have this reminder enough. Also you must work hard first in order to be kind to yourself. Don't be too kind to yourself.
Yes, don't just be kind to yourself, but also work hard.
Work hard and be kind to yourself. Like, it's just, gentle reminders. Or also it might just be a STB advertisement for people to come to Singapore or swimming pool advertisement to do sports. I don't know.
Yeah, no, that's good.
Or maybe just my face there.
Yeah, just reminding us of your journey.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, if you could look back on everything that you've gone through and the journey that you've had, what would you say to younger Ping Siu who was 7 and struggling to come to terms or understand what life, the card that life has dealt her?
if you have a dream, if there's something you really like to do, don't be afraid about what people may think about it. When I was 7, a lot of people said that I couldn't swim. A lot of people did not believe that I was eventually going to be an athlete. So don't listen to them. Don't listen to people who say no to you, unless it makes sense. But don't listen to the naysayers. And if you think you can do something, go ahead and do it. And you really don't know where you end up.
Yeah, just try it for yourself.
Just try it, yeah.
You know, that reminds me also, in one of my previous episodes, the guest Sonia, she also said this quote that she will keep with her for the rest of her life. That is, the thing that is worse than failure is regret.
Mm.
And like what you said, I think at the end of the day, if we don't try, we don't know. And if we fail, it's okay. We learn, we pick ourselves up and we go again. But don't live a life that when we are perhaps 90 on our dying bed and then realize that, shucks, I regret that.
Yep.
I should have tried. I should have at least gave it a good shot.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I think just trying, really putting yourself out there, you get to know so many more people. And to me, the people I've met along the way have really been maybe the best thing that's happened from this.
Yeah, that's so beautiful. Well, thank you so much, Ping Siu, for coming on the show, for sharing your journey so authentically. And thank you for who you are and, you know, truly doing all of us proud. Not just the medals that you've won, which have been incredible, but also in fully embracing and showing up for yourself and allowing us to really live vicariously through you.